So, tonight, though, we are going to talk about St. Francis. He is, how many people already know a lot about St. Francis? Anybody? Everybody does, yeah. Let's see what happens. What I hope to do tonight is speak a little bit about him. He's probably the most fun saint of anybody. It's hard to read about him, talk about him, listen to stories about him. There are many movies about him, just without feeling uplifted, which is an interesting experience for me because, as you all know, I was born and raised Jewish, and it just comes along with our training, which I honestly have to say I don't totally understand. I've never been able to make sense out of it, although I was very involved in it, and I was wed to this teaching that I'm about to tell you for many years. There is a very strong anti-Christ teaching and a very strong anti-Christian teaching. And it's not like anybody ever teaches you, says the words like Christ was horrible. It just somehow, it's subtle and pervasive. So if I bring Jewish friends to this service, I have to warn them that there's going to be a picture of Christ on the altar because it just brings up something. I mean, you will never see a Jewish person, you know, put their hands together like this in front of their heart. It's just, this is a Christian thing. Anything that feels Christian, you know, it's just, and it's so inbred. So somehow I had the grace, and I mean that, to be able to just jump beyond that with my spiritual awakening many, many years ago. And to really, I have to say, many times throughout the year, I feel the closest to Christ. I mean, I feel like he could be my guru. And I think we all feel that, like, more or less involved with one or the other of the masters at different times. They're probably reaching out to us in those moments. But I'm saying this all now because Francis was, you know, in a certain way, quintessentially Christian and stern and very austere. I mean, in some ways, he felt that way, as you all know. He refused to not only wear any real clothes, but they had to be uncomfortable. He would wear often what's called a hirsute, you know, something under him to be aggravating him. I read that if somebody gave him even old cloths that had been thrown away, but the cotton was too soft, he would stitch cords, pieces of cord, on the inside so that he was never comfortable. I mean, even if he went to somebody's house for food, if he was invited over and he went there, even if it was the bishop, it wouldn't matter. He would not eat food that was like good food. He would take his bowl that he had begged for, often people literally putting garbage in it. It reminded me very much of the chapter from the autobiography of the yogi, Two Penniless Boys in Brindabar, wherever, I think it was Brindabar, wherever it was, where at one point on that journey, when Master was trying to tell his friend, trying to teach his friend that they did not have to worry, that if they just knew God would be with them, God would be with them, you know, as he said later to somebody who asked him what it's going to be like when he's gone, he said, to those who think me near, I will be near. I mean, very profound words. But it's amazing reading books about Francis, the extraordinary similarities. This is a phenomenal book, which I would happily loan to anybody. It's written by a man whose name was St. Bonaventure. He was 11 years old when Francis died. But this is such a readable book. When I finished the first time several years ago, when I first started teaching about Francis, I bought like 4 copies of it and just gave it to people, Nirmaha, Asha, I mean, anybody I thought would enjoy it. It reads, you just get so engrossed in it. So if anybody here wants to borrow it, please let me know. I do have it all underlined and everything, but otherwise take it home. But it's incredible how many times if you borrow it, you'll see in the margins that I've written, oh, just like Swamiji, or this reminds me of this is Master, and I'm going to finish one story before I move on to tell you why I think that's true. But there's a point where Francis is also trying to teach his devotees, basically. What Master was trying to teach his friend, when Master said, look, you see that putrid food on the ground? You know, and they were in, you might really have had to be almost in India to appreciate this, but it's very hot all the time. I mean, stuff that is on the ground gets putrid, that organic kind of putrid, like horribleness with maggots, literally, very easily. And he just said, it's all God. I mean, and without a question, and his friend said, oh yeah, I'd like to see you eat that. If you eat that, I'll eat it. And Master just picked it up and without a thought just started eating it. And then he said to his friend, here, you promised. And then said no and tried to run away. But actually, Master put it in his mouth, and the reaction was not anything we need to talk about right now. But the guy didn't really believe it was all God, so it tasted like putrid food from around him. But Francis was very much like that, and he would take his begging bowl. And people were, particularly early on, appalled with what Francis was doing. Francis, very much like Saint Teresa, really started this life, and I think even more so in a certain way, very much involved in the material world. He was born, as we all know, to a very wealthy merchant, a cloth merchant, right in that same time where people really had access to things in the world that they had never had access to. This was in the 1100s, you know, and they were beginning trade at the time. So cloths were coming in that people could never do, and not only couldn't get before, I mean, not only did Francis's father recognize the possibility in that and decide to capitalize on it, but at a very young age, he brought Francis into the store. And Francis was this totally positive, very congenial, he had a great personality, loved to play. He just loved to play, and he loved to party in the best sense of the word. I mean, and there's records of all of this. Bonaventure, who I started to say who wrote this book, died when Francis was 11, although he attributes a healing that he had before the age of 11 to Francis. So it leads you to believe that maybe he either saw him or maybe the healing just happened. But all by way of saying, what he's writing about was written and is factual. Even though it was the 1100s, here was a man who lived right in his time, who wrote all this down. This book was written in the 1100s, so, or maybe in the early 1200s. So everything we're reading is factual, and if you read enough books about Francis or look at enough movies, you realize some of these stories are told over and over and over again because they happened. And the wording might be a little different, but different observers telling the same story. So he was somebody who just loved to play. He came from a lot of money. He had an extremely generous spirit. He would often be putting on big parties, pouring the best bottles of wine. You know, then was in the days of the troubadours, he played an instrument. He would walk through these tiny little narrow streets in Assisi, and he would be leading everybody in song. And he was very funny, and he was uneducated, actually, but extremely bright. And people just say he was like a lover. I mean, early on, he was a lover of women and a lover of life, but he had that great passion about him, which obviously just got transformed. And so very much like Teresa, I mean, who started out that way, but she was a much more, I shouldn't say much more, she was obviously a very sexy, sensual young woman too, but he was flamboyant, but in the best sense of the word. And you just see how that transformation happened in likeness and in kind, that love and that joy just wrapped itself around different things in his life, but really nothing changed. You know, nothing changed. I don't know if I told this story last week or not. When somebody asked Ananda Moy Ma a question about herself, and I think it was Yogananda, so I probably did tell the story. But when he said, tell me about your life, and she said, oh, Father, you know everything about my life already. He said, I know, but I want to hear you tell it. And she said, when I was, I'm not going to get this perfect because I had it in front of me 2 weeks ago, but not now, but it doesn't matter. When I was a thought in my parents' mind, I was the same. When I was a baby, I was the same. Then I grew into, young woman and I was the same. Now I'm here and I'm the same, and even after I leave this body, I'll be the same. I mean, she just goes on and says, basically, this is the spirit that you're looking at, and the spirit and the soul does not change. And then she and Yogananda had a great laugh about that. She said it much more beautifully than I just did, but that was the gist of what she was saying. And I think you see that in Francis when you read about him, that nothing really changed about Francis. All that changed is the way these qualities of the soul were made manifest. But what was most fascinating about him is that he had no idea. It's not like Yogananda, who was born, his mother was told before he was even born that she was carrying a saint. And he, as an infant, he was already doing things that would attract attention. By the time he was a toddler, he was just running his world. You know, he came in and he was spiritually advanced, and he used that spirit, that great spiritual effort or energy, and that's just how he lived. But Francis was not that way. He had no idea. I don't think it was a time. It's funny, there were so many religious wars going on. It just shows you the difference between religion and spirituality. People were killing each other. There's a part in this book, or maybe, I don't know if any of you own the book, The Saints Who Moved the World, but it's another fabulous book, and there's maybe six saints that the author writes about. It's just absolutely a brilliant book. I don't know who wrote that book, but clearly somebody's very intellectual. And even the introduction to that book, which I probably should have just Xeroxed for all of you, but it's rather long. It's really worth the read. The book is called The Saints Who Moved the World. Again, that's something else. If anybody's interested, I could just Xerox that introduction, not tonight, but at some point, and let you read it. He makes a case for this continuity of the continuity of truth throughout all of history as we know it. And he talks a lot about William Blake. I had not read the introduction to that book until yesterday, but I was very, although I've read each section on the saints, but I was very touched by it because it's an argument that I use a lot, because it's the truth that these people, and I said this in our first class, who lived thousands of years apart, thousands of miles apart, are all telling us the same thing. But he takes that argument and he shows how William Blake, whose name I often use when I'm saying whether it's Henry David Thoreau or William Blake or Einstein, you know, just grabbing people from different areas. I think I didn't even know the whole truth about how really what a saint in some ways William Blake was, and how he presented concepts through poetry that had not been spoken of before. I actually really learned a lot just from reading this. I did lose my train of thought about that, but what I wanted to say about Francis is that he had no idea of any of this. This is what I was saying. So these religious wars were being fought. There's a point in one of these books where, I forget what this head of, probably the head of the Muslims was called, like a sultan or something, maybe that's the word, I can't remember it right now. And at one point he would give anybody a gold piece who brought the head of a Christian to him. So, I mean, they were being paid to murder and to massacre, you know, which was not uncommon. Those were pretty dark ages, as we know. And even that man, when he met Francis, you know, he just fell totally in love with Francis. And not only did he not have him killed, but he tried to give him all these gifts, which, of course, Francis refused. He would never accept any gift. It's not even like he would accept it and give it away to poor people. He would have nothing to do with the material world. But I wanted to say there was huge religious wars going on, and people were taken with this materialism. So actually, in Assisi, although the bishops were big, and, I mean, these people had titles, but most people were much more involved in their material life than they were in religion then. So nobody was really thinking about spirituality or religion where Francis was in a very meaningful way. He certainly was not. I mean, in all of his boyhood ventures, he just simply wasn't. Even when he started having these visions, So the first vision that came to him, he decided that he was going to, he had a vision. There was a war that was started. They were frequent, you know, near towns would war with each other for power. And he had a vision or a dream where he saw all of these knights dressed in armor, and all of them had this huge cross on the front of their shield, and they were all coming towards Francis. When he woke up, he interpreted that as like, oh, I'm supposed to go to war. So he just took off and joined, just took off on horseback and said to his parents, I'm leaving, I'm going to go fight the war. He didn't get very far, because the next day he actually had a revelation, really, with God, his very first, where God said to him, you totally misunderstood that dream. I did not put a cross in front of you because you're supposed to be going off to war. You just go back to town. Basically, this is not the kind of war that you are meant to fight. You go back to town and your war will be revealed to you. Francis had no idea what was going on, but it was such a powerful, revelation. He knew it was the truth. The way I've often said, you know something's the truth when you know it absolutely beyond a shadow of a doubt, because we so seldom get to that place. That's not a common experience in life, to have no doubt, to know something when it just comes to you. But he describes it like that, even though he had to suffer through great shame going back, because here was Francis, who was, you know, cheering himself on as he was leaving on the horse, telling everybody he was going to go win the war for his town. And the next day he turns around and trots back. But somehow he knew that his experience, he knew it to be the truth with such clarity that even as he was being teased and mocked by his friends, you know, in a very male-dominated, macho, you have to get the times of what these people were living through, He just didn't care. He just took it. He just, knew that it was the truth and that he was meant to come home. And he actually waited for the next sign. And interestingly, he had many of these, many visualizations, revelations, hearing God talk to him, and he had no idea what they meant. Nothing. And then he would just go back to partying and drinking and carousing with his friends. And really, literally, it was the truth. The one good thing that was going on is that he was, the way he was in his father's store, really helped his father's business. So they just kept making more and more money. And even when his father got a little concerned about how much money his son was spending, he figured he was certainly worth it because he was bringing so much in. So anyway, it's just an interesting beginning for somebody. And it went that way into his early 20s, even when he was having some of these visions. But he had no idea, none. He was not thinking about God when this was happening. And he didn't even think of it as God when he got those realizations where he knew the truth. He couldn't explain it to anybody. He didn't try and explain it. For a man who, he was canonized within 2 years of his death, I think. But more important than that was that every person who met him after his early 20s, after an initial period of people scorning him and mocking him, but as he became completely realized, maybe is the way to say it, no matter where he went, no matter how much people wanted to disbelieve him, they couldn't. People were just completely magnetized to him. In the introduction to this book, this Bonaventure book, Donna Tartt writes the introduction, and it is so beautiful. She makes the point that he probably was the first Christian teacher, and maybe to this day, or not to this day, I wouldn't say it, but whenever she wrote that introduction to that day, the only one, or one of few, maybe it's more accurate, Christian teachers, who was so expansive, who was really talking about Sanatana Dharma, who really was talking about universal love. Like, he's somebody who could have walked into any time. He's been a saint who's been loved by all of the ages and by people of all religions. He's probably been one of, you know, his teachings have been like a great peacemaker, because anybody can read him and relate to him. I mean, how could you not? She tells the story that the way she got to know him when she was young, she was enraged by a lot of what was going on in her church and wanted nothing to do with it. But she was reading Franny and Zoe. And Franny, I think it was, who said in the book somewhere, "Oh, Francis is more lovable than Jesus by far." And that intrigued her. So she started reading about Francis, and she fell completely in love with Francis. She said it was absolutely true what Franny was saying. She relates to Franny like she was a real person, but, you know, what she was saying is the truth. Because here you are, a little girl, and he loves the birds, and he loves the rabbits, and all of the animals just sing to him and speak to him. And, I mean, it's really true. There are so many stories that describe his being able to communicate with every animal he ever came in touch with. And, you know, these are the things people know about him. They know about his vow of poverty. They know that he absolutely represented divine love. He was the first Christian saint who related to a divine mother notion. I mean, heart wide open. When we think of a lot of the Christians at that time, very male dominated, I mean, even the religious part. But he would actually speak about divine mother. So there was a lot of female quality to him. So the poverty, the heart wide open, and then this thing with the animals was just remarkable. There, each book tells the story of when Francis was dying, and he was so filled with joy. There are stories that he would just start singing, and his devotees or disciples around him would say, "Francis, you can't, you're dying, like you're not supposed to be singing." They wanted him to sort of die properly, whatever that. And he was like, "How can I not sing when I'm so filled with joy?" But the birds that were known to really dislike certain times of day, you know, they were night birds, they wouldn't come out during the day, or vice versa, would come to him at all these times and just fly and hover above him. They wanted to be near him as his soul was leaving. I mean, there are so many accounts of it that it's really remarkable. You realize, I don't know who was in church the day I told this story. Stop me if I told it in this class, but otherwise I'll tell you again. When I was in seclusion and I had that practice going on where everything I saw, I was reminding myself, you're looking at God, you're looking at God, over and over and over. And by about the third week of doing that, I mean, constantly reminding myself, I got to the point, I mean, I realized that I didn't have to think that thought, that I was just having an experience of God in the trees, in a leaf, in the ocean, in a rock. It was just happening for me, and it was lovely. I mean, it was living the truth. And then I was up at Ananda Village, and I was hiking in the woods, and I turned a corner, and there was a deer there. And I was, like, this far from the deer, and it freaked me out, you know? I mean, it scared me. It really did, and I turn, and I had this feeling that I was just going to turn my back on the deer, like not look in its eyes. And if I just pretended like I wasn't there and I faced the woods, that it would go away. And I did that so as not to startle the deer. And as I was turning towards the woods, I said to myself, "What is the matter with you? That, why would you, you've forgotten everything you just learned. Like, that is not a deer. That is Divine Mother right here with you." And I just let that feeling fill me up again, and I turned back to the deer, and she was just looking right into my eyes. And we took a walk together for about 10 minutes. I started walking down the path, and she walked, and we were this close. And every once in a while, I would turn and look at her, and she would look at me, and I swear, I mean, who knows, but I really had the feeling she was smiling at me. And, I mean, it was just so profound and extraordinary, because I knew later when I thought about it, I mean, fortunately I didn't think about it too much then, which is why we could take a walk together, that if I thought of her as a deer, or if she thought of me as a human in that moment, we couldn't have had that experience. That we both had to be transcending all of that to be able to be together the way we were. It was really an amazing experience. I have a friend who told me once, I never know if I should tell this story on her, so I'll let it be nameless, although a couple of times I've given it away, that she was meditating very deeply, and this is a woman who meditates a lot, and she does meditate deeply. I mean, everybody who knows her knows she just goes somewhere else all the time, into some place that most of us don't visit very often. But she was up at the retreat center at Ananda Village out at Bald Mountain. There's a walk you can take there out to this place called Bald Mountain. It's just a short little walk, but we all go there. We've all meditated there. And she was alone out there one day, and she was meditating very deeply. And as she started to come out of her meditation, she realized that a hummingbird was drinking from her mouth, which is just so... When I heard that story, that's what I did, what you just did, Christy. My mouth just dropped open. Because it really just says... You know, these are not experiences we can have if our human nature is right there. The animals won't come that close to us, which is what happened to Francis all the time, and more as he, I say more and more as he, and I didn't finish the sentence, because really what happened to Francis happened in a flash to him. The story is that in those days, there was a lot of leprosy. And leprosy, I mean, as you probably know, it was a horrifying disease wherever it was in the world. It is a highly contagious disease, and it's just a disease that literally eats you up. So it's a profoundly disfiguring and ugly disease. As it's eating you up, it's all by infection. And so, you know, people lose their noses commonly, or their whole mouths, or chunks of their faces, and they lose their hands, and it's contagious. So there was a dread fear of it, and that's how leper colonies got going, is that, you know, people were put away, and usually it was some form of a mission, a Catholic mission, that would allow themselves to take care of these people, which was the time, at St. Francis's time, there was one of the groups who just devoted themselves to taking care of the lepers. But everybody had an aversion to them, a serious aversion. And he was riding his horse one day, and he saw a leper walking at him, a profoundly disfigured leper. And he describes it. He said, I wanted to turn away. I was revolted. I mean, that's the word he used. And I wanted to turn away, but it's like he didn't turn away. And he couldn't figure out what that force was. He kept walking with his horse towards this leper, and he said, the whole time I was thinking, I've got to get out of here, I don't want to be here, but he got off of his horse, and this man had almost no hands, but he picked that hand up, and he kissed it, and then he was drawn to kiss this man right where his mouth would have been, and in that instant, he just felt nothing but pure divine love. He literally had that, in that moment, an instantaneous, complete transformational experience. And he said that he later said that he was in a wide open field, he said, not in the forest. There was no trees, nothing, which is how he saw the leper walking in him. And he said he mounted his horse and he turned around to look at the leopard with love and gratitude. The leopard was nowhere to be seen, just was not there in this huge, wide open field. I mean, it's just so remarkable to read these stories of what, you know, clearly look like complete miracles to us. And yet, because of whatever little experiences we've had in our lives, and because they were written, and because you see that once Francis knew that this human being who is there, very much like Master being here in the body, that the miracles were his normal way of life. You know, that's just what happened. It's like that beautiful saying, which I repeat a lot, of Thich Nhat Hanh's, where he said, miracles are natural. When they do not occur, something has gone wrong. Which means when we're not open to the truth, and that anything is possible, and that we can really communicate with the deer or with the larks or with whatever, you know, we forget that, and so we don't see the miracles that are there all the time. And when you read this book, you're just so drawn back into that reality. And really, because it's the truth, he didn't call it Sanatana Dharma, but that's exactly what it was. You read this book, somebody for some reason just decided to start writing all the miracles that happened in Francis's life. So there's like 3 pages of miracle. I mean, but every moment was a miracle. You can't really write them down. But that he's speaking that truth which transcends any religion. So it feels so in tune with us. You know, Yogananda called him his patron saint. He was very, and he spoke about Saint Francis a lot. And as you read this book, you can really understand why the teachings are exactly the same. The language is a little different, again, because he was living a different time. And he seemed to be so austere in everything he did, but he was living right at a time where materialism was on its biggest rise ever, really. Maybe until our technological age, where materialism descended once again in a big way. But I mean, really, it was so big what was going on. So we have to look at when these saints came and why they came at the time they did, and what their message was. Does anybody? Yeah.
I was just thinking when you were talking about the miracles in his life, and I keep hearing people talk about, you know, just saying the mantra of God or some kind of mantra, something chant in your head. And I do that all the time, almost like throughout the day at different points. And I notice little things, like anything can be a miracle, you know, a little twinkle in someone's eye or anything, you know, it's beautiful.
Yeah. And when you're attuning yourself to that energy, that's exactly what happens. And when you're not attuned to that energy, you just simply don't see it. And, you know, it's really interesting. I love that you talk about repeating the mantra. Let me just say what you're saying, because when we're repeating those mantras or affirmations, you know, and I was just thinking about this again today around something else. There is an energy that these masters put into these sacred words or these books. I know when Swamiji was first meeting Master, Master said, and Swamiji was telling me, just read AY, and Master said, did you like the book? And Swamiji's like, oh, I love the book. I mean, he probably didn't say it to him, but like, yeah, I read the book, and I got on the next bus and rode all the way cross country. But he said, yes, sir, I love this book. And Master said, that's because my vibration is in it. I put my vibration in it. Swamiji had never... He had heard of the word vibration, of course, because we all had, but not in that context. You know, to really understand, I know when I teach Med 1, and we're teaching Hung Sa, and there are a lot of people who don't want to use Sanskrit words, but I always say to people, if you can use Hung Sa instead of I am that, or I am peace, or I am love, all of which are fine, but those Sanskrit words have a vibration in them. The whole language is based on a vibration. So when you say those words are changing your inward vibration and attuning you to a higher and higher vibration. By higher, we mean that which will eventually be the vibration of Om. I mean, that's what we mean. It's not linear as much as it is expansive. So these mantras like Om Mani Padme Om, you know, which is the famous... one of the most famous mantras, probably repeated more anywhere in the world than anything, Ram Dass and many other people who had teachers early on for years, that was the mantra we all heard here. But they're very sacred, or the mantras that we repeat at our purification ceremony. If you say the Gayatri mantra even one time, you can't imagine what it brings to you because of the vibration. I know when I was involved with this other teacher that I've often spoken about, he used to sit me down on Sundays with a puja bowl in front of me and rice, and he would say, just sit there, Shanti Ma, and say the Gayatri 1,008 times. That's what he would say. Oh, my Lord, for years I hated it. because I just couldn't, you know, I wasn't still enough to be doing it. I mean, it was really a stretch. Now we can do it. Now these healing prayers that Ramani started doing over at the community, they started... I think around one of Swamiji's illnesses, but I'm not sure how we got into this thing. We've always known these mantras are sacred, but about a year ago or a year and a half ago, I can't remember now, where we started doing healing prayers, this is now over at the community, we didn't do the miracle, by going in and repeating the Gayatri mantra and the Mahamrityunjaya mantra. Are you still doing them on Monday nights? One of them said the Gayatri mantra. Yeah, so Gayatri 4, I don't know how many times you're doing it, but 10 minutes. So for a time, you're timing it. Anyway, repeating it over and over and over. Very healing. That Gayatri mantra has been being repeated for thousands of years by trillions of people. I mean, more times than we could count because these vibrations that we put into things. So when I read about Francis and I feel that vibration just has such a similar quality that it's very easy to move. And again, it's easy to find these stories that just feel so analogous to ours. So it's not important for me to find them right now, although they're very easily marked. Oh, because there was this wonderful, I just saw one of my things that I marked, and this amazing story about Francis. You know, there was no medicine in those days. I mean, people used to, if you had like a skin disease, which he developed something, I don't know what it was, they would cauterize it. But they didn't have cautery like we do, you know, some little laser. Now, actually, we cauterize with laser, but I mean, it's just simple and that's it. But in those days, they would take a hot iron. I mean, it was like being branded. That's what they did. And probably did cure a lot of skin diseases because it took off everything right down to the bone. I mean, it was pretty, it was so archaic, everything was. There was just no other way to treat things. So he developed something, and he said he started noticing he was feeling a little anxiety because he was going to have his face branded, a little anxiety. And so he just stopped, and he started talking to the fire. And he said, talk to the fire about, oh, Mother Fire, I love your heat. I love the way you purify everything. And he just talked to her the way he talked to everything. I mean, the way he talked to sister birds and the sister trees and my brothers, this, everything in the universe. And he totally attuned himself with that fire till he remembered that it was one. And then he could be branded. He felt no pain. And his whole thing, I mean, there's a story describing it. So I wrote in the margin, it reminds me of Swamiji with his root canals and the things he's had done, never taking anesthesia to have dental work, ever. He said he just doesn't relate to it in his body. And, you know, he's had major dental things done without any anesthesia. And so you see, I'm saying it to you more to say, as you read the books, there's just so many stories that remind us of stories on our path, because it doesn't matter what the path is. They're just realizing the truth. And it's so beautiful. What I thought we would do today, the way I've taught this class on St. Francis before has always been as a 3-hour class just on St. Francis. Obviously, that's not what we're doing tonight. But Swami Kriyananda wrote a beautiful little story about St. Francis. And he wrote music to go with it. And I don't know if any of you have ever heard the CD. I'm almost hoping not, because I want to play it for us tonight. And let me see if I can get to it here. What I'd like you to do, I told you enough of the story of St. Francis now, at least the beginning of his life, that you can follow Swamiji's story much easier. He'll repeat a little bit of what I said, but other things he won't. He tells a couple of other beautiful stories. The music is beautiful. I've never done this other than this St. Francis class, but when you have somebody who's told something as beautiful as Swamiji, it's definitely worth sharing. And what I would like us to do, if we can, is once I get this going, let's just close our eyes and listen to it that way. The way this got put up on, but we'll listen to this beautiful story and this beautiful music that Swami Kriyananda has written. So why don't we just close our eyes and try and just be absorbed in it. I'll adjust the volume. Let me know if you can't hear it. Isn't that just amazing? You know, when you think, I mean, talk about miracles. I hate to sound so silly, but Swami Kriyananda, I don't know what year he wrote that. And it's available through Crystal Clarity. I've looked this afternoon and we don't have any here. And I can't even remember right now what the exact title of it is, but obviously it's the story of St. Francis in Assisi, and I could find it out for you. But he just, you know, he goes to Assisi and he feels this inspiration, and through all these song and story, I mean, he writes all of that music, everything. It's just so lovely. Very touching to me, anyway, the whole thing. So Crystal Clarity has it, and we can get it for you if you want it. I can have, Annette can order a couple. We should keep some here anyway. Just so lovely. I had forgotten, I've not listened to that for quite a while, maybe since last year, so I didn't know exactly what part of the stories he would tell. It's quite a life, St. Francis, wasn't it? I mean, just when you think that he had nothing, he refused to have anything, that he felt as rich as anyone could. Does anybody have any? There's so many stories I could read from this book, but you know, I'm not sure that they're fabulous filled miracles. I'll take out all of my little. He had a great way of, obviously God spoke to him all the time through dreams and, as I said, through visions. But also at one point here in this remarkable story, which I will not read you the whole thing, but I just wanted to read one place. He's talking to one of the bishops. This is when he's really trying to get the order to be recognized. Because, you know, of course, there wasn't a Franciscan order. I mean, it was him. So he was trying to go to the great Catholic leaders of the time and saying, we have a new way of serving, and we want this rule, which he called the rule. Interestingly, he had 12 main followers, I mean, just like Christ, which I just find it fascinating. But so he was there, and all of these dreams, you know, the bishops were having dreams, and people were just dreams that would say to them, like, you just threw this man out of your church yesterday, but then they have a dream about him that night, and then they'd send everybody in the town looking for him, because the dream said, you know, you just threw one of the great beings of all times out of your church, you better go and find him. But at one point where he's talking to, they're talking about what to do. He's saying he wants to create a new order. And he's talking about all of these. He's talking in ways that nobody had ever heard anybody talk before. You know, about peace and generosity and poverty and these things that made no sense to people. So nobody knew what to do. So he's talking about the vicar of Christ was a man famous for his wisdom. When he saw in the man of God such remarkable purity and simplicity of heart, such firmness of purpose, and such fiery ardor of will, he was inclined to give his assent to the request, yet he hesitated to do what Christ's little poor man asked, because it seemed to some of the cardinals to be something novel and difficult beyond human powers, the things he was saying, he was trying to say to them about what miracles are. And he says there was among the cardinals, a most venerable man, John of St. Paul, a lover of holiness and helper of Christ's poor. Inspired by the Holy Spirit, he said to the Supreme Pontiff and his brother cardinals, if we refuse the request of this poor man as novel or too difficult, when all he asks is to be allowed to lead the gospel life, we must be on our guard lest we commit an offense against Christ's gospel. For if anyone says that there is something novel or irrational or impossible to observe in this man's desire to live according to the perfection of the gospel, he is guilty of blasphemy against Christ, the author of the gospel. At this observation, I mean, he's saying, we better be careful. You know, we're saying this can't be true, but he's proving to us it's true, and we're going to look like we're blasphemous if we don't grant him what he wants. At this observation, the successor of the Apostle Peter turned to the poor man of Christ and said, "My son, pray to Christ that he may show us his will through you." When we know this with more certainty, we can give our approval to the pious, to your pious desires with more assurance. And, Francis goes home and he prays, and he's shown the parable to come back and tell these people. And the parable is such, I don't need to read it to you right now, but that they get that there's no way that he's got to be telling the truth. The parable is so profound and works so beautifully. And so they look at each other basically and say that this vicar had seen that he had seen in a dream, as he recounted, that a little poor man, insignificant and despised in his dream, was holding up on his back the Lateran Basilica, which was about to collapse. And he turns to all of the other people in the room and he says, "This is certainly the man who by his work and teaching will hold up the Church of Christ." And, it just goes on, beautiful story after beautiful story about people just having revelations around him that were irrefutable. And everybody just, everybody fell into his love. So he's quite the man, and it's so inspiring reading about these people. I think that's how I got off before talking about vibrations being in books and just feeling them. I think whenever we want to be uplifted, we just open this up and read a little paragraph, and it's really something that Divine Mother sent these saints to us so that we could see what is possible. It really is. And I remember Yogananda saying to Dr. Lewis at one point, very sweetly, very quietly, he said, "Remember, Dr. G, God loves you just as much as he loves me." Meaning, really, everything that I am, you are too. There's nothing that I've done that you can't be also. And somehow remembering that in every one of these moments when life just feels hard, our greatness is so hidden from us. And yet these saints just keep coming back and just showing everybody, Francis sort of saying, it's really quite simple. You can just get rid of everything you have and just love God. See God everywhere and love God. It's that simple. He's in the birds, he's in the trees, he's everywhere, and there's story after story. There's just such a sweetness to the simplicity of the spiritual path that feels so difficult to us. But when you read these books and you're reminded of it, it's like you can breathe. That's what it feels like, Does anybody have any comments or questions?
I don't know. I'm going to go to explain it. The saints, it seems like what happens to them, how they live their lives, it's just happening to them. They let it happen. It's not intentional like an avatar. Do you think that is accurate?
Well, I think it's, I know exactly what you're trying to say, and I think it's true that the saints, at least the saints that we've talked about, let me just say this, I always get anxious when I'm about to make a great proclamation about saints or avatars. It feels so absurdly presumptuous, to be honest, but from my reading and listening and my own experience of some of this, I would say that the saints just come out and they, in a very similar way to the avatars, I think the only difference between a true avatar is that there's no time between birth and living their lives. So we get to see the lives of the saints in a different way because, and particularly these two saints that we've talked about, because they didn't know they were saints. They weren't living a life like that. So it happened to them. They were informed. But I think, we spoke about Ananda Moy Ma last week, and in some ways, although she had her full wisdom about her from her earliest time, she also just lived her life. Wasn't like.
I guess I keep thinking. If anybody who's self-realized, this is how they'll be. It's not. So it's not really remarkable. It's not. You know. It's, the saints, it seems, from what I know, which isn't very much, get held up like there's something that can't be true for anybody, but it's not true. You know, I mean, anybody could potentially be St. Francis.
Yeah, anybody could, and I think that's really true. But I think from the life of an avatar, it happens just... It's not like the opposite side of the same coin, but in a way it feels that way. When you read the book, the biography that Swamiji just wrote about Master, and you realize what he went through in life, in that sense he becomes, you know, the words don't say it, there are no words, but the word I would say was he becomes more human in our eyes. We see how we could be like him. That's not really true because he never becomes human. That's the unfortunate aspect of our mind that needs to speak of him in certain ways to be able to grasp it. But I think that the avatars come in and things happen to them which challenge them so that they can demonstrate to us how we could live. Some of these saints who were born and live a life first, we get to see from the other side what that... Is this what you're saying? I think we're just seeing it happen in two ways. One, you know, the story I just told this last Sunday in church, which was... oh, my goodness. I wanted to talk... I told a story about Master...
The sleeping saint?
Yeah, the sleeping saint, exactly. Thank you. When he left Sri Yukteswar. Mm-hmm. And it was so strange, but it was sort of funny and adorable. He says to Sri Yukteswar, who's an avatar, I mean, he's sitting there with the highest being that could possibly exist on Earth, and he says, I think I need to go off into the mountains and be quiet so that I can realize God. And as much as Sri Yukteswar tried to say to him, better you should spend time here than near some inert mountain, he just didn't seem to be getting it. Now, this is the same one who tells us what it was like to be an infant, you know, being born into a body felt like putting on a hot, heavy overcoat, a heavy overcoat on a hot summer day in India, no less, and who had already, by that time, I mean, that was after he ate the putrid stuff off the ground, never mind a thousand other stories that he had already shared with us in AY. So it's like, what happened to him that he forgot? And remember, and I said in Sunday service, who knows why that story happened? Who are we going to be to interpret it? Did he really, like, was a blind pulled down? Or did that whole story just happen so that we could see the humorful absurdity in what happened? But... So those things happen, difficult things happen to them, and we learn. As opposed to this way with the saint, where you think, that could happen. Because he was just out partying and drinking alcohol and having women and making money and loving it and sort of living for everything in the world like all of us. Now, of course, he was a highly evolved soul. That was a highly evolved soul. I remember recently saying to Davy at one point when we were talking, I don't remember what we were talking about, nor does it matter. But I said, you know, the truth is we're all on the same path. We're all souls going back to God. We all want the same thing, and we all have the absolute possibility of making it even in this lifetime. But the other truth is, because we know we reincarnate millions of times, we're not all necessarily at the same place along the spectrum, you know? It really might be that one of us makes it free in this life or in five lifetimes or in ten. And it may well be that one of us needs to be around another million or who knows, 20,000. I mean, I just don't know. We're not all at the same place because souls evolve. So, you know, we all have to stay open to the possibility that we could tomorrow have the same vision that Francis had. I mean, to know to take off every stitch of your clothing in the highest court and say to your father, I'm not just going to give you back the money that I took from you to build the church, right? He stole the cloth. He didn't stole it. He just went to, it was his father's story. He had worked in it all his life. He went off, he sold the cloth, and he was going to build this church because God told him. Francis, can't you see my church needs to be rebuilding? He thought he meant literally. Fair enough, not a bad first try. So he sells the cloth and he's going to do it. And it's so clear to him that he's meant to do it. When his father actually takes him to court, his father was enraged with him. And he says to him, to the bishop, look, no matter whether he's religious or not, whether it's for God, God would not want him doing something adharmic. He stole this cloth from me. So the bishop says, you know, you really do owe your father all this money. So Francis said, fine, I'm not only going to give him all the money back, I'm going to give him everything he's ever given me, because I used to call him my father, but now I know I was, will always say, my Father who art in heaven. And it's so beautiful, like, who of us would have done that? You know, this, I'm just rereading this afternoon. I looked at my own life, which you all know is a pretty devoted life. I mean, my life, all three of you know, almost everything I do is about the church and about service. And even when I'm in doing my medicine, it's about service. I mean, it's a good life. I'm leading a good life. But there are things in my life that I say feel karmic that I don't let go of them, you know, and I hold on to them. Relationships and things. None of it bad. It's not like I'm not doing anything bad, like bad. But, you know, it's, and then I started thinking today, look at this. I mean, the first, I forget what Francis calls them. He doesn't call them disciples, but we do. But the first man who came to be with him was an extremely wealthy man. And he had no doubt but that he was coming to follow Francis. I mean, he had a profound experience of perception of God in Francis's presence, and he was going to live the life Francis was living. But he said to Francis, you know, I have all this money. I really have a lot of money. Can't I just bring it along so we can use it to build churches? And I don't want anything. I'll wear the same clothes you're wearing, and I'll put on the same hair suit, and I'll beg for my food, but why should we give away all this money? And Francis says, you know, we'll have to pray about that. And so they pray overnight, and then phrases from the Bible come back to them, which of course they interpret very literally, and I could look it up right now, I don't remember them, but it doesn't matter. And Francis said, no, and they just leave all the money. You know, people left so much. You heard he was talking about Claire, who we all know, interestingly, Claire was like his sister saint, really, Claire and Francis. They were together, you know, the whole rest of their lives. And the most beautiful woman in all of Assisi, and then her sister, and then her mother. I mean, one by one by one, everybody just giving up every material thing they had, everything of any comfort, anything that had anything to do with anything other than God. You know, it's a lot of many things, but it all made sense. If it wasn't about God, it didn't come along. They just left it. It really, when you're on a path where you're saying, what I really want is to be practicing the presence of God every minute, then no matter what you have that's not about God, you have to ask yourself. I mean, it just begs the question here. It was very profound rereading this today. You know, just, anyway, I didn't come to any answers about it, but no matter where our lives are, you just think, what's next? What's next? But anyway, that's what I think, is I think when we get to see them rising up, again, not accurate terminology, but fair enough, the other, we get to see them living in this world that we live in, but with all the peace, all the calm, all the equanimity, you know, the experience of reality, no duality.
Well, it would be becoming self-realized. Yeah. Yes, St. Francis.
St. Francis, yeah.
In the
It seems that way.
And yoga known as already self-realized.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know why that distinction matters, but I don't know. It seems important to me for some reason.
Yeah, for whatever it is. I mean, to understand it in a way. Remember I said to you last week that when I, because I spent 8 years with that other teacher, and then people started asking me when I came back here, well, did I think he was a fully realized being? Did I think he was what Yogananda was? And for me, it just hit me like, how would I have any way of knowing? And for me, it didn't matter. Sankeshava Das, whoever he was, and he was certainly revered as a saint in India. Was he an avatar? I don't know. I mean, I would say probably not, but, you know, again, who am I? But I had so much to learn from that man. It was such a huge distance that it didn't matter. You know, it just simply didn't matter. There was, I couldn't absorb it all in this life. It just wasn't my karma, so there was so much more. But I think it is meaningful. You know, and Swami asked Master a lot of these questions. He said to him, you know, of all of the saints that you talked about in the AY, who of those were fully realized? And I think he said two of them. I think he said Ananda Moy Ma and somebody else. Somebody correct me if I'm wrong. There was one, I can't remember, I'm sorry. I want to say it was...
Saint with two bodies, maybe?
Hmm?
Saint with two bodies?
I can't remember it right now. But it doesn't matter. I mean, of all those people, when he was saying who had attained that level of samadhi, two of those people who were pretty great, every one of them. So yeah, I think there are differences and it does matter. It's so beyond me that I'm just thrilled to be reading about St. Francis and feeling the inspiration that I felt today. But I don't, you know, at all feel in a position to state his level of...
It's probably different for everyone too. Doesn't have necessarily look the same.
Right? No, it doesn't have to look the same, but there are levels. There are definite, you know, this is a science, so it does exist. You know, there are these different levels of samadhi that people attain, and it's all very clearly spelled out in some chapter of the AY, if anybody can really grasp it. Very difficult chapter to read. I find myself wanting to put the book down when I get to that chapter. When I was in seclusion this past summer, I really made, because I read the whole, one of the things I did is really read through the AY again carefully, very mindfully. It was a good time for me to do it, but I made myself read that chapter, but it really challenges me. And of course, you know, in this lifetime, I'm just not a yana yogi. I'm not an intellectual. I don't have the capacity, I don't have the patience. You know, I feel things intuitively, I love it, but when I have to actually learn it, very hard for me. So, I mean, that's just for me, but you could pick up that chapter and go into samadhi reading it. Who knows? All right. Isn't it great talking about these saints?
Absolutely.